Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian Insight podcast number 142. We're recording this on Friday, the 5th of November, 2010. I'm Steve Litchfield, and with me in Sussex, I have...
Rafe Blanford.
And up in sunny Edinburgh.
Sunny? Ewan Spence. I'm sunny. Does that count?
The sun must come out sometimes. And in Hull, I have...
It's David Gilson. Hello.
David hasn't got any specific topics for this podcast. He's been informed he's got to interrupt us a lot with insightful questions. So, Dave, I'm sure you'll just fine, David. Now, Symbio is the first news item. You may have heard that Symbian ecosystem has received effectively 22 million euros in funding from the European Commission, various private companies. That was the headline. In fact, I think the Symbian Foundation only gets 1 to 2 million euros of that, and the rest is all taken up with the different projects. Rafe, can you put some meat on this story?
Yes. So, as you say, this is a sort of 22 million euro investment, a sort of joint private-public partnership, sort of through the auspices of the European Commission. And actually, this is part of what's something called the Artemis Joint Technology Initiative, which is basically the European Commission's way of consolidating and encouraging investment. And in this case, it's in embedded software systems. And you see this all across the European Commission in various different bits of research and development, be it space, agriculture, etc., etc. And this is just particularly around embedded systems, of which, you know, Symbian is a good example. And they're really endorsing the Symbian platform as being important to the future of European sort of embedded system software. And they're seeing it as the future mobile operating system for Europe. And as you say, there's about 24 organisations involved, ranging from the big guys like Nokia and ST Ericsson, through some quite ones you might not expect, Santander for banking, and of course the usual suspects in terms of operators like Telefonica. But there's also a lot of research and development organisations involved, both private and university ones, and they will all be sharing this funding. It's led by the Symbian Foundation, but unlike some of the news reports you may have seen, this is not anything to do really with changing the future of the Symbian Foundation or being a plug for the funding gap that we've talked about in the previous podcast. This is really a side project that's just being headed up by the Symbian Foundation. And in terms of investment, yes, of course, this is pretty significant. 22 million euros is not a small amount of money. But I just remind people that a few years ago, I think it was summer 2 years ago, Nokia took out a loan for about 500 million euros for investment, mainly in the future of Symbian, some other things as well. So just, you know, to put it into the scale. But what this does mean is there's quite a bit of money for investment in things that are maybe more research and development orientated around the future of the platform. And so where this money goes is going to really be divided into three key areas, I would say. One of which is about making device creation simpler on Symbian. And that's the sort of the costs involved or the effort involved in bringing up a device on certain hardware. That's, you know, the integration process, if you like. And this is something that's always been relatively expensive on Symbian compared to, say, Android or Windows Mobile or some of the other platforms. And a lot of that's about the, you know, complexity of the Symbian platform, but some architecture choices that were made early on for good reasons. And it's one of the reasons, you know, you've got the power and resource efficiency. But it does mean it's quite expensive to create your first Symbian device. And if you're going to become a widespread platform, obviously that's not a good thing, especially if you're looking to get into embedded systems, which I'll talk about in a minute. So this will really tie in with the Symbian Foundation's existing SHI initiative. That's the software hardware, Symbian hardware extraction interface, which means it will be making the platform more hardware agnostic. It'll run on more chipsets, different types of memory, and that kind of thing. So therefore, it will be cheaper to create a Symbian device. The second kind of area of focus is really about, you know, improving some of the core enablers in the platform. This is the kind of the core technology that makes Symbian a leading platform. And one of the examples that's been talked about is asymmetric multiprocessing. And that's the idea that you can have chipsets with multiple cores, you can switch them on and off to be as power efficient as possible. So, for example, you're decoding video, you switch on all the cores, use a lot of power, but get it done quickly and efficiently. But if you're just in idle mode, you only need a single core on because there's not very much going on. But in order to get that working efficiently and effectively, you need to do quite a complex process. And this is something Symbian have already talked about with the SMP kernel and the move to the SMP safe platform as a whole. But there's room for a lot more research and development there. But it could also equally be around, you know, new advances in multimedia, ways of compressing images and video, or new things altogether. You know, one of the things that will get talked about is what can we do to enable mobile banking or mobile health systems. Finally, the third section I'll mention is sort of improving Symbian platform as an embedded system. And this is the idea that you could use the Symbian platform and things beyond mobile phones. We're going to see more and more embedded systems coming along as we sort of move into a world of ubiquitous computing. You know, sensors and devices will be all around us, and increasingly they'll need to be connected, always on, you know, connected to the internet or to some kind of cellular network. And existing embedded platforms aren't always particularly well suited to that. They're clearly going to be the big competition and the main thing here, but Symbian, designed from the ground up to be power efficient, to, you know, be connected devices, Symbian perhaps has a role to play here. And you should not think about this in terms of Symbian with its current UI. Just think about the core OS and what that might do. And so there is plenty of potential there, but there hasn't really been much investment here, simply because the main focus for the Symbian platform and Nokia, who are the main developers, has been on mobile phones. But, you know, we've said before that embedded systems present an area of opportunity for Symbian, and this Symbio's initiative, probably more than anything else, this embedded potential is going to be explored.
Just a couple of questions on that, Riff. First of all, making it cheaper to make Symbian handsets. So with the doing away of Symbian 3 and Symbian 4, and that it's just going to be a iterative process of evolving Symbian, first of all, how likely do you think it would be that we'll either get Samsung, Sony Ericsson back, or get new manufacturers? And also, looking at the embedded platforms, we know that MeeGo's on the way, and they're not just looking at handsets, looking at netbooks and also in-vehicle displays. How much of a potential do we think that there is for Symbian and MeeGo to actually get into competition now with this Symbio's initiative?
That's a great question. I mean, the first thing to note is, in terms of Symbian 3 and Symbian 4, that's largely irrelevant for the embedded systems, because we're talking about the core OS, whereas some of the big differences in Symbian 3 and Symbian 4, and of course that's all changed now, were around the UI. And so that can continue as before. In terms of Samsung and Sony Ericsson coming back in, I personally think that Samsung's very unlikely. Sony Ericsson is possible if we look forward a few years, but again, it's perhaps unlikely. The potential here is really in non-mobile phone devices, and you can think about appliances in the home, you know, smart connected fridges, or even more low-level stuff that's, you know, just home automation, for example, that, you know, you've got your intelligent curtains. It's kind of joking there, but, you know, there is a serious point to that as well. So when I talk about embedded systems, I'm talking about things that, you know, don't have display, you don't interact with directly, you'll interact with through another device, but they still need a certain amount of intelligence, and that the all-important bit really is the connectivity built into them. I'm just trying to remember what your third question was. Could you just remind me there, David?
I was saying about getting into embedded systems other than mobile phones, like vehicles, so
yes, okay, yeah. So
MeeGo and Symbian, yeah.
The competition between MeeGo and Symbian, clearly there is scope there, but I think what we're talking about here with Symbian is lower down than things like in-vehicle or, you know, netbooks or tablets. That's something that I think MeeGo will probably be more dominant on, from certainly from a Nokia point of view, and just in general. While Symbian could stretch up there, we've seen the problems there before, and it would require someone to come along and make a big investment in terms of UI and user experience, whereas that would not be needed really so much on user experience. You know, the majority of the software for Symbian to do that already exists. It would just be about putting in a bit of technology, probably around standards, and then actually being able to create and build the devices quickly. And these are, of course, very different in terms of hardware requirements to those bigger devices you were talking about. And so the clash between Symbian and MeeGo, I think, will still take place in that mobile phone space. But I think that tends to get overplayed to an extent. I mean, at least to begin with, I think MeeGo will be concentrated on the higher-end devices. Now, in time, it might move down, and certainly in terms of requirements, it's capable of doing so. But as with all of these platforms, and the same is true of Android, iOS, and Symbian itself, it's something of a moving target, in that in order to get the latest version, which has got new technologies on it, you maybe need a little bit more power, a little bit more oomph. And so by the time that MeeGo is sort of able maybe to address those lower tier devices, it's moved on and will need higher requirements. We've seen the same thing, in a sense, happen with Symbian. You know, the Symbian 3 devices do things that the earlier devices can't, and partly that's because they've got the extra hardware requirements. Perhaps the difference is Symbian is still capable of running on the lower spec hardware, And that's where the embedded systems may come in. But it's all up in the air. And as I said, this is a relatively small investment. I mean, it's still significant. You know, we shouldn't be calling 22 million euros small in one sense, but compared to the amounts of money that are being lavished on platforms on a daily basis, this isn't that big. This is more about the research and development, and certainly in terms of embedded systems, I guess it's quite a big investment. So Symbioz in particular is not really about mobile phones, although they will benefit from some of the core enablers, such as the symmetric multiprocessing. But a lot of it, I suspect, will go into, making it easier to create really low-cost devices and create devices around embedded systems. And as I say, smart curtains, or maybe an intelligent weather station, or something even smaller than that, just sensors that get embedded in the pavement or something like that. I think that's probably below the level Symbioz will probably sit at. But think of anything that could benefit from becoming an intelligent connected device, and that's, sensors all over the place, be it something like a pollution sensor. That could potentially cut costs if you can do it in an embedded way. So lots of potential, and hopefully it answered some of your question there.
I just love the fact that it's always the fridge that is decided to be the connected device in every single one of these. I mean, he has not played for Chicago for about 15, 20 years. I have no idea what William Perry is doing nowadays, but I'm sure that we could rewrite his brain. What's more interesting to me is the fact that this is... It would be very easy to portray this as Europe taking size. And when you look at the mess that you have in terms of state funding in Boeing versus Airbus... with the US putting a lot of money behind Boeing, Airbus putting a lot of Europe putting a lot of money behind Airbus, and trade restrictions, and governments helping trade, which they're not meant to do because of NAFTAs and various other treaties and such. Like, we've Steve, you've already hinted in previous article that software was going a little bit Europe versus America in terms of what people are looking for in a smartphone, and here we're now seeing the European government stepping up and putting money in here, and you already have the US government putting pressure on everybody to choose Microsoft at a software level in desktops. It wouldn't surprise me if in a year's time we might start to be seeing some sort of political trade war over the operating systems.
We've also got the various legal battles, the various diagrams floating around the net of who's suing who and what's happening. And there was some news this week on some of the patents that Nokia are suing Apple over have kind of been upheld. But that's very much an ongoing thing, and that will go on for years, and I suspect this will too. This is very much an American view of the world, and American OS is trying to take over the world, and here, Nokia have a very, very different vision of what a smartphone should be. And it kind of ties in with how we see a smartphone, having grown up with them and grown up with Symbian over the last 10 to 15 years. So yes, I think that there will be an element of battle going on here.
I personally wouldn't get too excited on the American versus European issue. I think it's a bit of political grandstanding in some ways. This kind of, governmental investment into technology structure is not unusual by any means. I mean, you only need to look at something like the internet, which effectively came out of similar levels of investment in the sort of, going a long way back, in fact. And so this is really partly about the European Commission deciding to make a software investment that it thinks is strategically important. So in that sense, is it sort of a full subsidy? Well, yes, but you get those in all sorts of places, and this is not limited to Symbian by any means. It's quite a common occurrence. I don't think it's suddenly going to break out into some kind of massive trade war over which operating system mobile phones happen to use, because this is what in Europe we have some of these more direct subsidies, but don't imagine that these don't exist elsewhere. And far more significant are probably the indirect subsidies through government contracts and things like that. So I perhaps wouldn't get quite so excited over the prospect of a trade war. I mean, sorry to be boring about it, but this is very much business as usual.
But it's good for our traffic.
It is interesting, though, that the other mobile OSs, iOS and Android and RIM's BlackBerry OS and Windows 7, they're all North American OS, and Symbian is the only one that's British stroke European. And that gives us a warm glow, if nothing
else.
Well,
I think the other thing you have to consider here is, although the OSs tend to get labelled as European or American, a lot of the development takes place internationally. So for something like Symbian, the big development centres are really, let's say, around Tampere, in Finland, London in the UK, then there's Beijing and India also contributing on a very significant scale. And similarly with Android, you know, it's actually fairly evenly split between Silicon Valley and Europe. There's a big Android development team in London, for example. So labelling them one as the other, I mean, I understand what you're saying. It's about the parent companies as such. And even with things like Apple and RIM, I suspect at least some of the development is taking place, is outsourcing outside the US. So as attractive it is to sort of say it's the evil Americans versus the, you know, good Europeans, or if you're an American, hey, it's the evil socialist-loving cheese-munching
cheese-eating yes,
Europeans versus the shiny American dream, we're the best, lovely, shiny, whatever Americans. I'm afraid that's just not the case. So again, I'll just put the dampener on your excitement.
I don't think the other thing that divides consumers as well, and this goes along the lines of what you wrote, Steve, because I agree with you. I think there's a philosophical difference about the idea of what a phone or a smartphone is supposed to be. I mean, at the moment, I'm kind of like splitting my time between an E72 and an Orange, the Android San Francisco from Orange, and my SIM card is still staying in the E72 because that's more of a phone and I can depend on it. Whereas for San Francisco, it's getting more like a little tablet, really, rather than my phone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that philosophical divide, which is something Steve very accurately commented on a recent editorial, is been a pattern of the last 5 years, and really is one of the, for me at least, is the big explanation for why Symbian didn't take off in the States in quite the same way. And a lot of this comes down, I've said it before, is that, you know, America had a kind of smartphone system created out of PDAs, whereas in Europe and the rest of the world, we really had a smartphone created out of the phone. And, yeah, you know, it's the Nokia model versus, in some senses, kind of the Palm Pilot, the Trio model. And of course, you can over-exaggerate this, but I do believe there is a difference. And actually, I think increasingly it looks like, you know, that kind of computer or PDA-led model, which is dominant in the States, you know, will apply at the top end. But I think in general, smartphones, as you move lower down the tier, become more phone-like, and that pattern seems to be remaining in place. And so, you know, in addition to the pattern we've talked about, sort of Europe versus America there, you do get a bit of top versus bottom. And so, you know, all the really high-end users, even in Europe, you know, they like their iPhone and they like their Android devices because they are the sort of computing-like and they're high-end users. But then you have to make that division when you transfer into the mass market. And ultimately, people are still looking for a communications device first, not a computer. And so that's where it tends to switch back the other way, which is perhaps why Symbian has enjoyed so much success at the low end. Quite apart from, you know, the requirements and all of that, is that a lot of people will prefer having something that's phone first rather than mobile computing first. And I think that's certainly the experience I've had with friends and family who are maybe less tech literate, is that, you know, yes, they like playing games and things like that on, you know, some of the tablet devices or the big touch devices. But when it comes down to a device they want to use day to day, often it's the phone functionality and the battery life and, you know, simpler things like that that win out when they're making their final decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Staying on that topic, I know you and you've had the Nokia N8 for about 2 weeks now, and you do have to give it back to Nokia PR rather sadly. But if you had been allowed to keep it, would you make it your main device, the Nokia N8, good enough to be a general smartphone for you, gaming aside? And is that good enough?
Well, you see, you've put the qualifier in there, says it's good enough. For me, and yes, it is. But I, because it's so close to the X6, because it's so close to previous Symbian phones, there isn't that headache that I had, say, when jumping from the N95 to the E75 of huge amounts of changes. Because most of the changes are under the hood on this thing, in the software and the kernel and battery handling and everything, you know, it's not that difficult to jump up. Now, that is where the problem is with the N8. In a mass market point of view, it's not that different to use when compared to other devices. And we talked extensively in the last podcast about the UI changes. So if you want to go into depth about what is coming up, why it's coming up, what's happening, go listen to number 141. You know, it's clearly a holding device. You know, it's got great hardware on it. It's much, you know, the insights, what's important to the networks. Remember, those are the people that buy the majority of phones from Nokia. You know, they want to see more battery life. They want to see good use of the network. They want to see the OS husbanding the resources in the wider world, because then more phones can be sold. They don't have to invest so much in towers. So for the people who are doing the major buying decisions, the N8 is a great phone. For people who've grown up with Symbian in some form or another, the N8 is a great phone. You know, no, but I suspect my viewpoint is going to be quite, you know, the fact that it hasn't changed that much in the UI makes it as awkward to get into as any other Symbian phone. Would I keep it? Yes. Would somebody else with a Symbian phone upgrade to Inc. be really, really happy with it? Yes. Would somebody coming to Symbian brand new? Well, you could ask the same question of the X6, the N97, or whatever. It depends on what they're looking for. And I think the N8, in marketing terms, needs that fresh UI. Somebody suggested that they should have changed all the icons just to make it look a little bit different. Yeah, I know it's silly simple and I know we should poo-poo down on it, but I think that would have been a smart decision, and that would have made it felt new, which meant that more people would have been comfortable to try it. As it is, I don't think it's a comfortable phone to start with.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you say that, Ewan. I have to say, for me, the going to the N8 from things like the X6 is not just a matter of a few things under the hood. There's everything's different, everything's transformed, everything's faster, and everything's slicker. And the technology jumps with the graphics processing, not just for games, but for example, video playback, being able to play back just about any video and any codec and any resolution at any bit rate. It makes a huge, huge difference for me. And of course, the jump in terms of things like the camera. I know that a lot has been made of the N8 camera, but just one small anecdote, if I may. I was shooting a photo for the C7 review, which should be up, the part two of that, as you listen to this podcast. And I'm pretty good at taking photos, I think. I position my subject, in this case, the Nokia C7, in good light, in a window ledge, on a nice background, set the N8 up to close-up mode, and take my shot. Thought, okay, that's a good photo, I'll use that. I brought it up on my desktop screen on the 19-inch monitor, and it looked absolutely stunning. I thought, this could be a press shot from Nokia taken by some contract freelance photographer. If you get things right on the N8, it can take some stonkingly good shots. And I have been doing this camera comparison between the N8 and, for example, the C7 with its EDOF camera. And I have to say the N8 still wins out by miles, not just because it's 12 megapixel, but you get the large sensor, the large lens, and the Carl Zeiss optics. They do make a big, big difference. So for me, the N8 is a step change up in almost every department from the X6, which itself I was seriously considering as a main device about 6 months ago, but no more. I'm afraid the N8 has eclipsed all others. I'm talking to the C7. We wanted to just touch on that because we've now had two C7s in the house, and Rafe's had his for about a week or so. I've had mine for about 3 or 4 days. Rafe, is it possible to summarise the C7 just for the podcast? I've been moderately impressed by it. Certainly, as the price comes down, I think it's going to become a stunning buy. But for me, there are some serious caveats. You mainly liked it because of the replaceable battery and the styling?
It wasn't so much the removable battery, although that is a factor, of course. But really, it was just a more approachable or more accessible device than the N8. You know, the N8 is a very fine device. And if you want the camera, absolutely, that's the one to go for. But in terms of how approachable it is to sort of a bigger group of people, I think the C7 wins out. A couple of reasons for that. One is its size. It's just that little bit slimmer than the N8. The design, I think, is absolutely top-notch. There's also things like it's got real buttons for the send and end keys. And it just, I don't know, there's something about it that just makes it have a broader appeal for me. And I think it's maybe, it's less chunky, less masculine design than the N8, gives it that broader appeal. Yet it retains almost all the features of the N8, with the camera exception, of course. And that makes it a very capable handset indeed. And if you consider its price point, and at the moment I think the Nokia store has it up at £370-odd, but it's, you know, if you shop around, it's easy to find it for £315, and that will should soon get to the £300 mark. And comparing that to other £300 devices, you know, there's, you know, the C7 really is excellent value in that sense.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add some points. I mean, just rewinding to the N8 for a brief moment. Again, this goes back to what Steve wrote about how the philosophies behind phones, whether you want an internet-connected tablet-like phone or you want a a phone that is a converged device that's got everything in. Again, I think you would especially get the N8 for the camera. Otherwise, why not get the C7 or C601? Because if you want to have a good camera with you all the time but don't want to be carrying around a point-and-shoot, well, the N8 is better than a lot of high-street point-and-shoots. But I think another thing, and I'll let... Since all of you have lived with an N8 now and I haven't had a Symbian 3 device, I'll let you all jump on me and correct me if you disagree. But the other point is, from my experience of using Symbian 3 devices at Nokia, well, the other thing that I like, especially at the moment, seeing as I'm going from an S63rd edition E72 to an Android device a lot at the moment, is the fluidity and speed of the user interface, and especially the frame rate on the screen, because I think one thing that I think ordinary users will find that high frame rate, smooth scrolling, reassuring, because it means the device is responsive and it's there and it can answer whatever you want to do. And the Symbian 3 devices have that, and I think ordinary users will appreciate that. But as I say, you three have had an N8, so jump in.
I would say that there is still some way to go in terms of if Symbian and Nokia wanted to mimic the iPhone and Android sort of pixel dragging fluidity, whereby when you start dragging your finger over a screen, things react as if they were imprinted on the screen on a piece of paper. That's there, for example, on the home screen. At the moment, Symbian and Nokia have implemented it that you do a gesture swiping across the screen, and then after two tenths of a second, the operating system, okay, there's a gesture being made, I'll switch home screens. There is a rumor afoot that this is going to be changed to be more iPhone-like. Also, for example, if you're on the applications folder with all the with 30, 40 apps installed, and you want to drag up the page of icons, as you drag, there's an imperceptible 1/10, 2/10, 3/10 of a second lag while the operating system works out that you're doing a drag gesture and then starts doing it. I'm sure these things can be changed if Nokia choose to do so. The current way of doing it certainly isn't a showstopper. Once you know what it's doing and why it's doing it, it actually makes more sense. But there is an argument made that in order to appeal to the people who have now played with iPhones and Android devices, which do it in a slightly different way, that Nokia maybe should toe the line and think, okay, hang our philosophy, we'll go with the crowd.
Just to add some insight there, I mean, this is very much a design choice rather than a technical limitation. And I think we probably will see the home screen in particular change to that kind of visible drag method, very shortly. But one of the issues I have with this general complaint, and I'm not being particularly aggressive here, but people say it should be like Android or the iPhone. I don't necessarily agree with that philosophy. I think sometimes, yes, it makes absolute sense, but sometimes there's a very good reason for having a different design choice. And, you know, this came up earlier when Ewan said, can we change the icons? I think, no, consistency on the icons and having a globally understood iconography is actually something that's very important. And I don't necessarily think just because it's done another way on, you know, your competing platforms, that becomes the way to do it. Nokia in itself can set these standards and say this should be the way to do things, much as it did in some ways with, the UI key, the Navi key early on in the history of mobile phones. The other thing I'd just add in here is that I think people often think, you know, in the rush to compare the Symbian 3 devices to Android and to the iOS, you need to remember that actually the biggest potential market is still those who haven't yet bought a smartphone at all. And so it's that kind of addressable market question. It's much easier for Nokia to access those people who maybe on Series 40 phones or other non-touch phones than it is to win back Android and iOS. And in that sense, so I think it was Julian Forgeau who described it as a retention device, and I think that's a very apt description in that this is something to appeal to existing Nokia customers and those maybe who aren't smartphone owners, rather than, you know, Android or iOS owners, who I think that's the customer segment that MeeGo will very much go after. And so this kind of idea that they should always be compared isn't necessarily completely accurate, particularly as you move lower down the market. I think it's probably fair play for the N8, but for devices like the C7 and the C6, you know, the biggest competition for those is really going to be persuading people to move on to a smartphone or a touch smartphone for the very first time, not to transfer from another touch smartphone device.
And I can actually just back up what you're saying. I mean, with some empirical evidence, because I've just recently given my mum her first smartphone, and it's actually a Nokia 5530. So I mean, it's a pretty budget Symbian One device. But and she's actually getting. I mean, she isn't a technically minded person, so I wasn't sure how she would go on. I'm actually surprised to see how she is getting on. I mean, she actually is saying that the Symbian interface is intuitive to use, and she hasn't had any problem sending messages or even getting into the App Store. I mean, I set up the account, but she's away installing applications, because I mean, I think even still the Obi Store interface on Symbian 1, not Symbian 3, is still a little clunky. Absolutely. In my opinion, and a complete novice user is still getting away and enjoying using it, and even enjoying using web browser, which is, I mean, because we all have things to say about Symbian web browser. But
so David, if I may interject there, do you think that's because of the familiarity of the kind of the menu-based system that she was maybe using on a previous device, or is it just a general familiarity with the kind of concept of how the UI should work?
I think it's more the latter, because the phone she was using previously was a Sony Ericsson feature phone, a K700. So I think there's maybe a slight bit of familiarity, but I think it is probably more just the general mental mapping of how a general phone would work.
Yeah.
What is interesting, though, is that Nokia are listening to people, or appear to be listening to people, who say you need to do what another big manufacturer is doing. And it comes down again to an issue that we come back to time and time again. The larger addressable market doesn't have a voice online, but the small addressable market is going, you need to act like this on iOS or Android or whatever, because that is what people expect. There is a danger here that Nokia do not find the balance between making it comfortable for people who are coming from the old stuff and other platforms to leading the pack. You know, as you said, with the Navi key, you know, other manufacturers followed Nokia. What Nokia have to be aware of is that they're not seen as following Android and iOS by putting in this home screen functionality or the swiping. There needs to be a happy balance there of the Nokia way and the expected way. Otherwise, they will be seen as a reactive company. And they need to stop that. They need to be proactive, certainly coming into what was originally called Symbian 4 and what is now just called Symbian.
Let's move on. We've got a few more things I want to mention before the podcast finishes. The Nokia C601 has started shipping, which is the first the Symbian 3 devices with a clear back display. Also, I think it's a 3.2-inch capacitive touchscreen, but otherwise, those very similar specs of things like the C7. I think, Billy, you've got your eye on the C6 as the main device. You want to do the...
I have, yes. And before we do that, David, what do you mean the little 5230? Come on, that's the best handset out there. This
5530, it's not quite as well specced.
Ah, well, there you go. In any case, the C6 is going to be the foot soldier. It does not have the perfect camera. It has a more than adequate camera. Its specs are similar in terms of some of the hardware. It will do the same things as the N8 and the E7 and the C7. But I think this is the one that the network's going to pick up and throw out into the pay-as-you-go packages. You know, by the middle of next year, I'll see this down at the £100 pay-as-you-go mark, fighting devices like the San Francisco. Maybe there'll be a slightly lower spec one to get down to that price point. The 5230 does have to drop off one or two things, but this is going to be the grunt. This is going to be the 5800 of this version of Symbian. It is going to be everywhere. It's not going to win design awards. It's not going to be the sort of handset that you'd see Paul McCartney tot around at the MTV Awards. This essentially is the Heather Mills McCartney handset of the Symbian world. It's absolutely everywhere. It's earning lots of money, and nobody's quite sure why.
Do we know a price on the C601 yet, Rafe? I'm guessing we're talking about sort of £250.
Yes, I think the sort of press release price was around the €265 mark. So yes, I would imagine £250. I mean, I would compare this very much to the Nokia 5800. know, it start will start off with a slightly premium price as all new handsets do, but it will drop, I guess, towards the £200 mark. I think Ewan might be a bit optimistic on the £100 price point there.
Crossing my fingers.
But there will probably be, you know, follow-up devices to this coming along in due course. And just as the 5800 in the end turned out to be something of a sleeper hit, I think the C601 could follow in its footsteps. And it does, you know, it is very capable in hardware terms. You know, it has the same chipset, the same graphics stuff as on the N8 and the C7, many of the same sensors. And it's really only the big differences are slightly smaller screen, no internal flash memory, so you'll be reliant on memory cards, and, you know, the camera on the back, obviously. And other than that, you know, for all intents and purposes, it will be able to do everything that the C7 and the N8 can do.
Yeah, I think the certainly on pay as you go with a nice healthy 50-60 quid subsidy from the operator, on pay as you go, the C601 should be around $119.99. Sounds like a good point to end up on a particular network operator, but we shall see. You had a couple of small news items, one labelled Android theme and one labelled location services numbers. I've no idea what you want to talk about, but could you do it briefly?
I can, yes. For all of you people out there who go, you know, the best form of flattery is imitation. The ADW launcher on Android has just received its first Symbian 3 theme. You can have the Nokia grass, the blue background, and the little cuddly icon set that we talked about that should have been changed earlier on the front of your Android phone. All the fun of pretending it's a Symbian device. In all seriousness, why not? I mean, people's phones, hardware, software, they like to have them interchangeable. Somebody's had the smart idea, and there are now, let me just do a refresh on the page on AppBrain and find out how popular it is. It has a 4.5 out of 5 star rating, and it has slightly less than 50 downloads.
Aww. I'm installing it on my San Francisco now.
We demand screenshots. It's a Friday. At least it is when we're recording it. The other one, which is more interesting, was a report in the New York Times technology pages Thursday, November the 4th. The fact that location-based services remain small and do not appear to be growing, certainly in the US. This is a weird one because, you know, Foursquare is reporting that their adoption rate is as fast as Twitter was at this point in Twitter's life cycle. But at the same time, they're not seeing a big impact in internet trendings. Now, obviously, it's a survey, and surveys can be written to reflect whatever you want to do. But again, it's still location-based services, and specifically third-party location-based services, that are still trying to grab a hold, to try and find something to make these worthwhile. And as this goes on, you know, yes, Nokia have that. They have it on OV Maps, but they also have the mapping technology as well. They've got the big important bit of where stuff is. What you do with that stuff, everybody's still trying to find out the answer for that. And until somebody gets a solid answer like that that works, you know, location is just going to keep sort of, you know, it's going to be like a car engine with the choke pulled out. It's just going and not actually take off. Everybody's trying vouchers. I still can't see a golden opportunity for location in any of the web services or web 2.0 stuff. I can see lots of people trying, tell me where, Foursquare, Go Wallet, and such like, but I don't see anything that's actually taking off yet. Have I missed anything obvious?
Well, there's two things I'm wondering, Ewan. First of all, is it possibly social network fatigue? Or is it that the idea of privacy is like, because in the news we've had data leaks for years, and then there's always some story about Facebook leaking information on opting people in. So do you think people are just trying to protect their privacy, because just saying where I am here minute by minute is just a step too far?
It certainly is as part of both of those issues. Fatigue is one that we've come back to time and time again, and it's why IM never really took off. And in terms of privacy, well, here's the interesting thing. 5 or 10 years ago, if you'd suggested Twitter or Facebook to somebody, the privacy barons would have been up in arms and would have had discussions in the Houses of Commons. And, you know, this is almost as deadly as cake. But, you know, nowadays, it's just accepted. So, you know, maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, maybe when Steve and I's kids are at the age where they're going out, nobody will think twice about saying, I am here. But, you know, that's a long time to wait to build your businesses now. You know, and I'm wondering if the boat will be missed, if it will just be accepted as all you do is broadcast it and that's it.
I think all of those offer, you know, possible explanations. I'd also add into the mix that it's kind of a usability issue. These things aren't easy enough to use in the mass market. You know, you have to actually be aware of them and take a decision to actively use them. And until they're sort of fully integrated into the handset and the way people are used to doing things, I'm not sure they're ever going to take off. And this is a lot to do with context sensitivity and that kind of thing. But while they remain almost silo-ized applications, I think they're always going to be a limited market which these can access. It's going to be people who are keen to go ahead and do this rather than people who might go, well, I'll do it if I get some benefits from it. And at the moment, the benefits you get from it are too invisible for most people to bother, you know, taking the steps necessary to learn how to use these services. The exceptions come when you get useful things in local search, which has exploded and continues to do so, is a location-based service, but not in the sort of way that obviously you're thinking about there, Ewan, in terms of Gowalla or Foursquare or something like that. And so it's the most useful location services are going to continue to grow, but those that need kind of input and maybe less visible user benefit are perhaps going to stall a little more.
Yeah, yeah. We're right out of time, guys. I'm just a brief pointer towards C2010 as SEE, the Symbian Exposium and Expedition or Exhibition or whatever you would normally put in here. November next week. Rafe will be there on the floor at Beurs van Berlage in Amsterdam. See them, SEE2010.org, if you want to find out more about that. It's free to attend. Anybody can turn up. If you're anywhere near Amsterdam, then do pop in and see what Symbian are up to with their foundation and all the various people coming in from Nokia and Accenture and ST Ericsson, which I should mention, because we mentioned that earlier. ST Ericsson has nothing whatsoever to do with Sony Ericsson, which is a common mistake. Rafe, the ST Ericsson has to do with embedded systems, aren't they? And they're more in terms of internals.
Well, they're actually a chipset manufacturer, and their next chipset, which is the U8 something or other, is going to be one of the first multi-core chipsets that's used in Symbian devices. So definitely one to watch. And they're quite heavily involved in all the multi-cores and the symmetric multiprocessing I was talking about earlier. So they're actually out of a merger of Ericsson's chipset division and Microelectronics, I think it was, their chipset division. So actually they're a pretty big company.
Yeah, yeah. So they'll be there as well. And of course, so Rafe will be bringing you all the news and announcements next week on the site, and we'll be trying to keep up back at base here and chip in with some analysis. In the meantime, it's goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield. It's goodbye in Sussex from
Rafe Blanford.
And goodbye up in Scotland from
Ewan Spence.
And in Hull, David's itching to say
bye-bye, everyone.
We'll see you all next week on the All About Symbian Insight. Bye for now.